Session number 21116, Wheel 7.
Sid Nuttall, Wheel 7.
The eight parrot were quite small in number. They'd been dropped up and down the place as almost everybody. Everybody was short of numbers, and it was having difficulty trying to take this village to get go down to get the bridge. The major that was there at the major of the parrots said he would put every bit of firepower he could down this main street, and I had to drive down this main street with these parrots with these para engineers to take the explosive down below the bridge. It worked. They put a tremendous amount of firepower down the thing. They fired the 2-inch mortars, all the machine guns firing down, and we went down it. We had a couple of the REs were wounded getting through. Once we got clear of the village, we had a straight run then down the road to the bridge. Dropped the engineers at the bridge. I went up to the far end and far end of the bridge. I could see the rope coming up there to give them some covering fire if people came. If people came down the road. They got in position. They shouted me. We came back, blew the bridge. Once the bridge was blown, the Germans that was in Turan seemed to disappear into the countryside. They pulled out. There was no point of them staying there, so they pulled out, and there was no further trouble. I was then loaded up with wounded, and they sent me back to the field hospital that had been set up. It was not far off the main dropping point, and I took them up there. Eventually, found a place. They got medical attention. About this time, they had a flap on. The people attacking from the south. There was part of a 21 Panzer SS Panzer regiment attacking from the south, and they were attacking quite strongly, and a bit of a panic. And what they did, they gave me a job. I said, right, and they gave me a load of bodies, all the spare bodies they had, to form a platoon and to go down towards where they coming up and set up a position, which I did. I took them down. We moved down. We actually dug into positions. There was also the RURs were on a flank of us. They showed us where they wanted us to dig, and we formed up there. We didn't get overrun, but it was a bit tight at time. And then about 6 o'clock in the morning, the Germans pulled back. We did no idea why they was making good headway, and they pulled back and altogether and moved south again. We were told later that the division, the Panzer Division, of which they was part of, found a gap in the sea landings, the gap between two units, two beaches, and they decided to try to drive to the coast, and then to run down the coast. And as it happened, they recalled their tanks. They almost made the beach. But they didn't make it, and so the attack eventually petered out. I had then no job to do, so I took the people back, and I had the job of going around bringing wounded in again, and I met some very, very brave people, conscientious objectors. And they volunteered as parachutists. they would not carry arms, but they volunteered for the first airborne div, and they was they dropped by parachute and to bring in to help the wounded, but they wouldn't carry arms. Now I take my hat off to them. You know, people talk about conscious objectors, but these were definitely genuine ones. They, you know, they could not kill, but they was there, and I was, well, the first time I'd really met them, and they were NCC on the shoulder, non-combatant corps. Another air landing came in, in the afternoon, with gliders coming in from all over the place. The things were getting easier. The commandos had landed, that had come in by the sea, had come across the Orme Bridge, and they had moved up to form part of our perimeter. That was at the same Pete Lovett, his crowd. They came up, they sea landed, came across the Orme Bridge, and came as part of our perimeter. The nine para. I found out afterwards, their attack went in with very, very few troops. The gliders were supposed to come in and land, just one appeared. That came in and crashed. It was on fire. It crashed inside the perimeter. They actually crashed it inside the wire. It was on fire. Another one actually missed it and landed to the south of the place. But they attacked with what people they had. They fought their way into the battery. The people in the gunners took to the ground. They simply went down into the tunnels and pulled the doors to. But they'd no explosive. They'd nothing to destroy the guns with. The sights had been taken off, of course. They'd take the sights with them when the Germans left. So it's very difficult to destroy a gun without explosives of the right type. And of course, the people that came in were supposed to be bringing the explosives in, but the planes were caught fire. It was a glider that caught fire, I should say. So anyway, they put them underground at the right time. So they never fired on the beach when the beach landings were taking place. So there again, it was a success. Although it was a bit of a shambles. They then pulled away from the battery to the perimeter, and the following day the commandos launched an attack on the battery again. They did exactly the same. They put them underground, but they couldn't destroy the weapons because they hadn't got the kit to do it with. It all being lost. But Navy kept it quiet, because the Navy had guns trained on the spot, and every time they tried to open fire, they would show up from the sea. And I heard afterwards that they didn't come out of their position till August. The Germans held that battery till about the 12th of August before they pulled out. They were never successful in disrupting the troop movements coming in. But they held the place, and we just hadn't the equipment to actually put them down. And I was also told that on the 50th anniversary, the sergeant major and the commanding officer of that battery came down from Germany and took part in the celebrations on the 50th anniversary. I should have liked to have been there myself. Right, the sea, we started to get some sea stuff coming in. The B echelon had landed by sea. The heavy equipment started arriving into the area, with more and more guns coming in. Things were easing off quite a bit. Now, originally, the sixth airborne div was going to be taken out as soon as it was relieved by the sea landing people. They would go back to UK, get ready for next operation. It's a waste of very highly skilled troops being just infantry, being used as infantry. you know, they take a lot of training, and to expend them as infantry is rather wasteful. But they had a heck of a storm, and it troubled getting stuff into the into France by sea. Consequently, the airborne div had to stay, and I believe they stayed. Some of them stayed up to about 3 months. My job terminated when I was about the D plus eight. About D plus eight, the anti-tank battery of the airborne forces of the 6th Airborne Div had arrived. They'd lost some of their guns, so they took the two guns that were still in action of our guns. They took them onto their own. So we now had nothing to do, and we came out with some of the wounded from the sea. We pulled back, and I came out on D plus 10. With me, Remy officer, wounded Remy officer, and all the people that had no jobs in life, we came out, and we moved back to Beaufort. And then from Beaufort, I got a bit of leave, and then I was sent back to Kilmarnock in Scotland. The first time, the next part of any operation I took part in was Operation Barker. It was a drop by the 3rd French. They dropped near Dijon, south of Dijon in the forest. Dijon is a very, very heavy wooded area. The British dropped units at the north of Dijon. The idea was...
These are all SAS
units. All SAS units. There was about 69 operations, SAS operations, after D-Day. The whole idea was to stop reinforcements from arriving at the beachhead. They had bombed most of the bridges on the Seine. They'd done the most of them on the Loire. Consequently, it had made a funnel. So the Germans were having to bring everything in by rail and by land through this funnel, coming just north of Dijon, and with funneling, they got a lot of units there. We did a heck of a lot of attacking, destroyed railway lines, broke rail lines, shot up trains, attack convoys. We operated from the same area as some of the Marquis. The Marquis was queer. There was two lots. There was the communist and there was the non-communist. They hated each other's guts. We found that the communists were the most effective. They had a will to fight Germans. The other ones weren't all that keen. But they also, most of the railway people were communists, the railway engineers, the line, and we got good information on train movements. And when we train movements, we were told that there's train coming through with this, that, and the other one, and we could attack it or could destroy the line. We became adept at blowing lengths of railway off. You could take a length of railway off quite easily with the... We used to use one pound gun cotton slabs, put them one on one side, one on the other, lash them together, detonate them, and it would sever the line just as though it cut it with a saw. You should do this on a bend and throw the bit down so the train comes along, and of course the only thing that holds it on the lines are the rims inside the wheels, which stop the thing from sliding off. Take a piece of line out and the train would take off and fall down the bank. There was a case with one time where one of the engineers, the fireman and the fireman and the on the train, he knew it was going to be attacked, and they came through and jumped off and let the train go on. The Mackie were queer. They had some vehicles, but they used to use the ones that burnt wood burners. petrol was very difficult to get hold of. They had wood burners. You had a towing attachment, like a small stove. Chop the wood up, put it in, put a fire underneath it, and cook it. It produced a gas, and the gas could be used to drive the engine. It wouldn't drive it very fast, but it would drive it. And they had these for moving people about at night. The Germans eventually started moving everything at night, because during the day, the Air Force was strafing the roads. And so they used to move most of their stuff at night. So we used to move most of our stuff during the day. We used to use the roads during the day to move away from the place we was in, the woods, to move up to a place to attack. And then we'd wait for the night and attack at night.
What were you armed with?
With Vickers Gaze, I dropped with a Jeep. I dropped second day, and we dropped with an armoured Jeep.
From what?
From Halifax bomber. Halifax bomber dropped Jeeps. Drop them on a crate. It's like a pallet, like a big pallet. Four chutes. They bounce a bit when they landed, but you can't kill a Jeep. You know, you can bend it, and it still kept on going. I had a... All the radio work was in French. I didn't speak French, which follows. So I had a VVA, a sergeant, as my radio man. He was a member of the French SAS. And he operated the guns at the back end. I had my guns and a driver, which I was operating Vickers Gaze.
What did you call this Frenchman?
VVA. He was quite a college boy. His father was a doctor, and he was being trained for a doctor. And he and another, one of his friends, had stolen a boat and set off for England on a rowing boat. They'd been picked up about 8 or 9 days later by a destroyer in the Channel, and they were dehydrated. They were both put in hospital. But a very brave lad, VBA. He and I got on very well. Anyway, things were getting on. The breakout had happened. The breaking out from the beachhead. Patton had swung round Paris and was heading for Epinay, the Champagne place, Champagne Centre. He was heading there. The CO of the unit was with the French. Heard that. He was heading up there. There was very little coming through now, because they was actually pulling back, so there was very little coming through for us to shoot at. And the CO decided on his own, without any orders, that he was going to beat Patton to Epinay. So we packed up and we with the Jeeps, and we headed north. And we reached Epinay day before Patton came in. We was actually in Epinay when Patton drove through. The French then they came out of action, and they then they stayed at Epinay. They reformed. They got all their people together, and they reformed it before they pulled back to UK. I was flown out of Epinay with the Brits. We was flown back early on.
How dangerous was it for you on Operation Barker?
It was dangerous, but not all that dangerous. We had the advantage. We was attacking from cover. We was attacking them. We had every advantage. They killed a lot of people, and they stopped a lot of supplies coming through, and we didn't take many casualties. It was a bit it's scary. But all warfare is. But when the adrenaline starts to flow, you stop being scared.
Did you take any prisoners?
Very few prisoners taken, because we had nowhere to take them. The Mackie never took any prisoners. If we'd taken them, handed them over at the end, they'd have shot them anyway. At that time, Italy had issued his orders that SAS and commandos would be shot. Would be interrogated and shot, so that there was not many prisoners taken. the British SAS had quite a few shot, but of course I wasn't with them at the time, so it's not part of my story. We got back to UK. The next thing on the map, next thing that was come up for us, we was going to operate with the Belgium squadron. The Belgium was going to drop north of Arnhem. It's the time on Arnhem coming along. The Belgians had been doing reconnaissance behind the German lines in Holland for quite a while, finding spots to make parachute drops. They're very, very effective. The idea was they would drop them north of Arnhem. They could then radio troop movements of reinforcements coming in and get fighter bombers to come down and strafe them. But of course, it was too late. By the time they was going to drop north of Arnhem, obviously they're not going to make it because the tanks were already attacking Arnhem itself. So there was no point in this dropping to the north. So some of the Belgians dropped to the north with the idea of infiltrating through the British positions and hoping to set up a breachhead to pull them back, because it was obvious that it was a flop, and we had to. They had a small beachhead on the north of the river, and we tried to get to got. They dropped us, a small number of us. We dropped south of Arnhem, and we dropped right into the Guards Armour Division. We then tried to get across the river with the Dorsets. The Dorsets had ducks, and the idea was we could get across the river. Once we got across the river, we could operate as escorts, leading people down to the to evacuate the rest of the people from Arnhem. We never got across. We tried two nights. The river was so strong that a duck was not making headway against it. We came north of the place, and we got swept straight down the river. Ducks are quite useless things if there's current. We got fired on, and we had to come back to our own side. After 2 days, they said it's pointless, and we flew back to UK.
And what was your drop like on this occasion?
It was behind our own lines. We just dropped among the Guards Armoured Division. We didn't know whereabouts we were. All I knew, I saw a tank, and I didn't know it was one of ours and one of theirs, quite honestly. Although the thing that I used to look for was the radio op aerials. The British always had the aerials on the turrets, and the Germans had them on the hull. So that was one of the identification points we used to use. It was an easy drop. A couple of people had sprained ankles, but it was a good drop. We got back to UK, and we hadn't much to do till right at the back end of the war. They got a job. The Canadians were going to make a drive from Holland straight across Holland to the north coast and cut all the people up on the cut everybody off on the North Sea side. They were going to operate in their normal way, which they do, bombing front shell areas. I was told that the Dutch government asked if the Canadians wouldn't attack that way. With all the dikes and the dams, they said that if they got these things smashed up, it would put Belgium back, it would put Holland back 1,000 years. So the only alternative was to put parachutes in, and the only parachutes were available at that time was the SAS, the French SAS. And they got the job at Operation Amherst. They got the job of dropping on a line 60 mile long. in front of the Canadian Army. Their job was a number of bridges, they were strategic bridges, to capture these bridges and hold them so the Canadians could roll through. They also had to attack an aerodrome at the north, at north end of this 60 mile, attack an aerodrome and stop the fighters from interceding. Originally, was going to do it with the Dutch resistance, but was told that the Dutch resistance had been infiltrated, so they were going to do it without notifying the Dutch at all. Now, this 60-mile stretch, it was very difficult to drop any jeeps there for the canals and the bridges and the water. Awkward place to drop vehicles. So we decided to drop the vehicles at a place called Coeur d'Ordon. The jeeps were to be dropped about 30 miles to the right flank at a place, I think it was called Coeur d'Ordon or something of that nature. It was quite close to the German frontier. It was an area that had been wrecked by the Belgium SAS as a landing, as a dropping zone. So the jeeps were dropped there from Halifax. We then split up and we fanned out from there and motored across country to this main line, to this main road where the French were dropping on. Our jobs would be to shoot them in onto into strong positions, shoot them out if they wanted cover, to find ammunition, get ammunition on from airdrops and things of that nature. The Dutch had told them that it would take them 72 hours to get this 60 miles. As it happened, it didn't. They had difficulty getting across the first river. It took them 10 days. By the end of 10 days, the French had run out of ammunition. They were fighting with German weapons, captured weapons. They'd run out of food. The Dutch had no food. The Dutch were starving. We had great difficulty getting any typhoon to attack. The Tiffies used to fire rockets, and we used to be able to get them down by radio onto a target. The great trouble was that the radios the French had were not compatible with ones the Canadians had. We couldn't talk to them. We could use our radios and talk to UK, and UK could then talk to the Canadians. So it was very difficult for us to get anything done at all by radio. We signal to England. England signal to the Canadians, and the Canadians then respond by bringing the planes down. But it just didn't work. But of course, it's one of these things that happens. We did have some drops. The typhoons were dropping ammunition, but they couldn't. They were not dropping it very successfully because they weren't designed for dropping it. They were normally, they're just fighters. But they were dropping containers from the wing tank positions. And if we saw one come down, our job was to, our job, when I say ours, the 20 liaison people, was to swan out with the jeeps, pick up the ammunition, pick up the supplies, and get them back into our bridgeheads, into our positions. We took quite a lot of casualties in the north. They had quite a few captured too at the end because they actually run out of everything and had to surrender. But of course, by this time, the Germans knew they was losing. They knew it was all over, more or less. And so they didn't attempt to shoot the people as it was ordered, that all SAS would be shot. So the French, although French had quite a few captured, they wasn't shot. And eventually came back to us. 10 days it took them to get up there. We then had to go back to UK.
Was your effort with 20 liaison units part of Operation Amherst?
It, Amherst.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was part of that operation. Operation Amherst. I must have done something right because they gave me the Croix de Guerre. The French gave me the Croix de Guerre with Bonstar.
How big was this 20 liaison unit?
It was a very small unit, actually. We was all kinds of people. We had all specialists. Some were some radio specialists. But we had probably